there are a lot of assumptions that people in the quote-unquote old guard have about women's place in animation and what we're capable of. And I'm just glad to see the attitude shifting, even if it is really incremental.
Where we celebrate women working in animation, illustration, and comics. In an effort to share their stories, we not only cover the steps they have taken to get to their dream jobs, but also the struggles. We highlight artists, writers, and producers, explore the ups and downs of working in the industry, and discuss female representation behind the scenes and on the screen. Ever hear of Over the Garden Wall? Harvey Beaks, Star versus the Forces of Evil, or the Cartoon Network short Back to Back Space? Well, she's a writing badass, and she's here on the Ink and Paint Girls podcast. Amalia Lavari joins us to discuss her path from the rainy weather in Michigan to studying experimental animation at Cal Arts in California. We also discuss the progress of female voices in entertainment and her thoughts on creating things you want to be remembered for. What is your opinion about the amount of women in the industry?
Oh, no, opinions already. I feel very optimistic. There was an article that came out pretty recently about Adult Swim and the number of female creators they have, which I think might be around zero. And then comments that were made about, you know, women in animation by people in higher up positions there, and a lot of people were posting it on Facebook and stuff and saying, like, you know, this is really dire, and I agree with that, but I also, from what I observe, I feel very optimistic, because when that news came out, you know, there were a ton of people rallying for more exposure, more presence, more recruitment, and so to me that indicates that progress is on the precipice, and whatever the opposite of progress is, you know, sort of like ignorant, like obsolescence or misogyny or sexism, like that's becoming very embarrassing. And people are embarrassed for people who are not aware of that. And so just the tone of things, the shift, like you can kind of feel things moving in a much more positive direction, and part of that is articles like that coming out, you know, so, so that's sort of a specific answer to a much broader question. I really do hope that the playing field becomes even.
Give us a summary.
A summary.
Yeah, okay. Of yourself.
Sure. Where to start? So, as a kid, I lived in a lot of different places, we sort of moved around a lot, and then settled mostly in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I'm used to, like, rain, overcast stuff. I'm still, like, kind of irritated at the sun and direct sunlight and heat, even after around 13 years of being in Los Angeles. So I guess I'll lead off with that. I went to an art school in northern Michigan called Interlochen. They had a writing program there that was really great. And then I went to Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. And for the first while there, I thought that I would be a music journalist. And then I ended up kind of slowly easing into film and taking more film classes. And my thesis there was a film that had stop-motion elements. Like, I just kind of tried to do some very janky, like, DIY kind of stop-motion, and using that, I applied to CalArts Experimental Animation Program, and I ended up going there for 3 years, and then I had a lot of random jobs for a long time, and around the same time, a bunch of people who I had gone to school with remembered my writing classes, from screenwriting classes, and asked if I wanted to jump onto different projects. And so that's sort of how I broke in, was by being remembered by people that I kept in touch with. So the first thing that I did was a pilot for Cartoon Network called Back to Backspace. And that was a really amazing experience to be able to sort of see the whole pipeline of how a pilot is made from concept to completion. Mm-hmm. Pretty soon after that, I was brought on to Over the Garden Wall, which was my first writing job. And then right after that, I started working on Harvey Beaks, where I was for about 3 years. And that just ended very recently. And over the course of that time, I've also done a lot of story consulting. So a lot of stuff that they were developing at Amazon and Disney and Nickelodeon and a few different places, like, they would just bring me on to help shape a story or help develop something with someone who maybe was more of a visual artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been really fun. Like, it's been really... it's expanded my brain a lot, being able to do freelance at the same time as being on a staff.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think that it helps, as a writer, to have a background in animation production. Because it's sort of like, you know, if you're a director and people are like, oh, you should take acting classes to see what it's like. You know, like, if you're writing for people who are going to be boarding stuff, you want to have an idea of what that experience is like for them so that you can make it as painless as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you worked in animation production before you got your first writing job?
I worked in animation production for, like, a few weeks or months. I don't even remember. It was a very short stint as a producer, very briefly for a company which I will not name because the experience there was just bad. Just really, it's like still, like, it's interesting, it's still the worst, like, job experience I ever had, and I think that it was kind of a gift because it pushed me away from animation production, where I might have stayed for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and into just sort of having a life, you know, for about 7 years after school was done. So I jumped into sort of a string of non-animation related jobs. I worked at Cine Family, the movie theater on Fairfax, for two different stints of a few years each.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for the Prostate Cancer Foundation as a prospect researcher, which is sort of like where they give you a name and they ask you to find out as much as you can about that person because they might be... you know, potential donor. And so that was actually really fun, and I ended up, you know, it was a very writing-intensive job.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how qualified I was for it, but they kept me on because they said that my profiles were funny. And so that was a really good sign, you know, because I was like, well, you know, like, I wasn't really pursuing a career as a writer at that point, but I definitely thought it would be really great to someday actually have a job as a writer instead of doing this forever. So, yeah, I got some very kind of quiet but encouraging signals before really diving in that it was something that I could probably do.
When was, like, the moment you knew that was what you wanted to do?
I think that's just what I fell into, like... I knew that I wanted to write in some way, and I didn't really know what form that would take, and I kept a notebook in college of ideas, where I would just, like, I would write down an idea, just like a short sentence, and then I would use a little, like, I would put a little star next to it if it was, you know, animation or, like, different symbols next to what the ideas could translate well into. So some ideas were, you know, short stories, some were songs. Like, I was trying to just kind of, take a shot at any medium that was fun to do at that point, And I ended up getting to a point where almost every single idea was an animated one. And so I think that was when I made the connection of, like, maybe this is something I should pursue after undergrad. So I'm glad that I did.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, because then the opportunities that presented them to yourselves to yourself eventually were animation.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I started at CalArts, I was pretty sure that I would, like, I went in thinking that I would study stop motion animation,
mm-hmm.
and that I would just create my own work, that would be the life that I had. And after one semester, I was just like, no, like, that's not really, like, stop motion is so labor intensive in a way that doesn't leave a lot of room for the writing part, and the writing part was my favorite part. And so I just kind of gradually moved in that direction. And I took the same screenwriting class every semester at CalArts with Nicole Panter, which was awesome. And that also kind of helped me realize that what I needed to do was get a writing degree from an animation program. So I prepared myself for one job, and I'm glad that that's the one that I have now, you know.
And you also write for comic books.
Yeah, so Over the Garden Wall launched a series of comic books after the series was done. Through Boom, and they brought me on to write a series about The Woodsman's Daughter, which was really interesting because it was sort of, it wasn't a totally blank slate. Like, Pat had ideas about where he wanted the story to go and what, you know, like, what he wanted the whole, I mean, certainly the tone of it was already established because of the show, but there was a really nice chance to flesh out this character and figure out what she was about, and yeah, there was just a lot of space to move and to navigate.
So it was pretty fluid, like, being able to write between both.
You mean time-wise, or?
I guess, like, the script formats are different.
Yeah, it's very, very different, because when you are writing a comic book, you're basically storyboarding with words. Like, you have to describe everything that happens. And you have to, like, there's separate sections for, you know, what's going on in the panel, what the dialogue is, and if there's any narration or anything like that. So, it's just more to think through. If you're writing a script, the bulk of the page is going to be dialogue. And if you're writing a comic book, the bulk of the page is going to be description. And so it was just a mode that I had to switch into. And for me, it just took longer. But I think it depends from person to person, you know, like what the amount of time and energy expended is for each format.
Yeah. What about the editing process, like getting notes from Boom? Like, versus, like, getting notes from network on the shows?
It's very different, and I'm sure that it's really different for, you know, I've only ever worked with Boom, so I don't really know what it's like for other imprints, but they were very, they just gave us a lot of space to do what we wanted.
Nice.
And they would run it by, like, when the script was finished, they would run it by Pat, and sometimes he would have some notes about, you know, like, logic, or, like, sort of, like, the rules of the world, or just creative sort of ideas. And so that was nice to continue collaborating.
Nice. Yeah. Which one do you like better?
Writing for television or writing for comics? Well, what I will say is that writing for comics is not, you can't really live off of it.
Mm-hmm.
And can when you write for like, it's not just on a practical level. I never really thought, like, which do I prefer, because it's not a choice between which life you can have unless you are willing to have another job as well. Like, I'm not really sure how a comics writer, unless you're writing for, you know, sort of really popular superhero stuff, like, I'm not sure how you would live unless you also had another job or a lot of other jobs. And so But in terms of what I enjoy, I mean, I do enjoy screenwriting more. Mm-hmm. Because it's more fluid, like it's a more organic kind of feeling for me, but there's not that much of a difference. Yeah.
Over the Garden Wall. Let's talk about that for a little bit. I mean, it was a mini-series. I thought that was a little crazy that, like, because Cartoon Network, like, pretty much always has series, and that was
it was the first mini-series that they did. And they had worked with Pat before. He'd been a creative director on Adventure Time, and he'd also done the Tome of the Unknown short. And so he'd sort of demonstrated that he was capable of, you know, a tremendous amount of output in a short amount of time. And I think that's why he was sort of an ideal choice for that, for the first miniseries that they would do.
Yeah, nice. And it was also, like, so dark. And, I mean, Cartoon Network has had dark properties before.
Sure.
But I just thought this one was, like, so out there. Like, I'm curious what it was like in the writer's room. Like, did you guys write together and then go off and, like, refine solo? Or, like, how did the writing process go?
It was pretty unique, and it wasn't really, like, the process was different from anything that I've done since then. But basically, there was sort of, like, a period of pre-production where we were in different places. And so it was me and Pat and Tom Herpick, who boards on Adventure Time. And we were just sort of working through story elements. Pat had a pretty good idea of, you know, Wirt and Greg and Beatrice. They, you know, there were still some things that they were trying to figure out. I think that that kind of gelled when they cast Melanie. Like, it really, she brought a lot to that character. Because she made her sort of sympathetic. Yeah. So there was like the pre-production process, and then there was the actual production where I would go in, and there was just a lot sort of going on at the studio. And Nick Cross was the creative director, I believe, was his title, and so he was sort of contributing an enormous amount to the sensibility of it. And then Pat had a rough idea of what he wanted the 10 episodes to be, like the rough beats of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he would give me like a premise and say, okay, like, you know, let's flesh this out into an outline. And then we would sort of go back and forth. So some days, you know, I'd be in there and we'd talk for a long time, and other days he would just give me something and I would go and try to expand on it, and then bring it back to him and he would sort of shape it more. So it was very cool. It was great, yeah. It was really cool. And also Pat, you know, he knew that it was my first writing job, and so he took that seriously. Like, it was important to him that I get an idea of what the position is like, what, you know, like, what the job is actually like. And so he was really an ideal person to work with for the first job.
Nice. So you weren't, like, hazed or anything?
No. No, I mean, I can't even imagine what that would be like, you know.
Me neither. I just
that, like, to think of animation writers hazing each other, it would just be so gentle, you know. Just, you know, it's like, oh, took your string cheese out of the fridge and left it on your desk. Now it's room temperature. Like, it would, you know.
Yeah. So I feel like, unlike other shows, there was a lot of, like, subtext to, like, many things through Over the Garden Wall. I mean, and the ending was, like, open to interpretation. What's your interpretation?
I really want to say, because I like that it's open to interpretation.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess what I'll say is that, like, I think that it's a really positive ending, and it's one that felt very true to my experience as a kid. Like, you know, it's like there's points when you're a kid where there's sort of a blurriness between, like, your imagination and what's, you know, like, what's occurring in the world. Mm-hmm. And so I actually, that's one of my favorite parts about, especially the last part of the series, is that I mean, it's sort of like Calvin and Hobbes, you know, where I remember when I was, like, an actual adult, someone was like, oh, you know, it's so cool how they have the story about a kid imagining all this stuff. And I was like, oh, what do you mean? Like, it's Tiger's real. It's like the thought that, you know, that it was just Calvin's imaginary world was, like, somehow shocking to me, which I guess that says something about like, my, you know, ability, or not ability, my willingness to sort of believe ridiculous things. I appreciate when any sort of show or piece of writing or song even is able to sort of zero in on that feeling, you know, of, well, it might be real, it might not be real, and it doesn't really matter whether it is or not, you know. It's sort of about how you experience it. But I appreciate people being curious, you know.
Yeah, totally. When you're writing for these animated shows, or just anything, like, do you bring a lot of your past experience? Like, do you remember being a kid and use that to fuel it?
I think I do, because the stuff that I've written for, a lot of it has been about kids. Like, Harvey Beaks, all the characters are around 10 years old, and so it helps to sort of think about that age and what I was going through and the different kind of loyalties you forge and the different things that you believe. And, you know, it's sort of like people think about childhood in a very nostalgic way, like it was carefree, but I don't see that, really. Like, when you're a kid, it's like emotions are so heightened and everything you experience is like, it's your entire world, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you're operating with this very interesting tunnel vision until you get a sense of what else is out there. So yeah, I think inevitably, you know, you end up sort of mining your childhood for interesting emotional experiences, but I think you can also just kind of, I mean, adult experiences also work their way into the content,
mm-hmm.
because people are so childish, including me. You know, it's like there's so much that that adults do that really echoes the dynamics of children relating to each other, and so
mm-hmm.
you know, there's never any lack of inspiration for writing for kids.
Going back to when you were working those odd jobs before you got into animation,
mm-hmm.
It sounds like you had a pleasant experience, but were there any like dark days when you weren't sure like you would get to write professionally?
I don't think I really thought that I would get to write professionally, so it wasn't really like a that wasn't hovering over my head. You know, the assumption that it would ever be possible wasn't really something that that I internalized.
That's nice.
And I mean, the jobs, it's like sometimes they were great and sometimes they were terrible. Sometimes they were very boring. Sometimes they were very challenging. What I'm glad about is that I just had a sort of typical experience of my 20s before kind of settling into what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that was valuable, because I have more experiences to sort of sift through. You know, I've met storyboard artists and writers who also, you know, like, they had careers in journalism or medicine or, you know, just like a lot of people come at it from such different angles, and I think that can only help, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's encouraging to me that you can have a totally different career and then like transition into animation or any sort of screenwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And bring something like valuable to the table.
How do you stay inspired?
It's like, I want to say something snarky, you know, like,
do it.
Horse tranquilizers. I don't, you know, it's like, how do I stay inspired? I think, well, there's a quote that I'm definitely going to botch, and I'm pretty sure that it was Flaubert, maybe, And it's something like be orderly and balanced in your life so that you may be passionate and violent in your work.
Ooh.
Yeah, which is, like, pretty lofty when you're thinking about, like, writing cartoons. But, you know, it's like, what I've found is that when you're in your 20s, you think, like, how do I have a happy life? How do I achieve my dreams? Like, there's just, the goals that you have are much loftier, and you lose sight of the day-to-day. And the thing that I have gained, wrangled? I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what the word would be. What I've returned to is the idea that if I have good days, then the work will improve. And so I try to make sure that there's a real balance and calm to the rest of my life. And that includes, you know, making sure, like, just, I'm a pretty social person. I used to think I was an introvert. I think a lot of animators and writers are introverts, and I just kind of assumed that I was one because of what I was interested in. Mm-hmm. And then I thought about how big of a role my friends play in my life and my family, and how I get weird if I don't, you know, talk to people regularly. Like, if I don't have a social experience built into every day, like a meaningful social experience, like making sure that I connect with people, that I touch base with people that I love, like, then my brain kind of atrophies a little bit, and I have less to say in my work. So there's no, like, main source of inspiration other than pretty rote stuff, you know? Like, it's like I try to keep track of, you know, it's like I try to gravitate towards artists that I like and keep track of their work. And I don't mean, like, actually gravitate towards the people.
I understand.
I mean,
maybe in a way you want in their orbit.
I mean, I don't know how valuable that is. I think I used to think that that was valuable, and now it's sort of like, I think the friends that I have are just so talented and generous and really just alive, vital, very impressive, impressively sort of present people. And so that's sort of what I think really keeps me going, is feeling connected to humanity.
Like, that was such a thoughtful answer. Like, how did you come across it? Do you just, like, do a lot of introspection, like, often?
I mean, call it what you know, navel-gazing, I think, is probably, you know, it's like, you do end up spending a lot of time. I think I heard somebody say something once. It was like, you know, 80% of writing a novel looks exactly like lying down on a couch. And so, you know, I like that exaggeration. I like the acknowledgement that a lot of gestation for writing is just being alone and staring at the ceiling and sort of turning ideas over in your head. And so, you know, a lot of times it does end up being kind of self-reflexive and self-indulgent, and so you just kind of try to pivot towards usefulness in those moments.
Yeah.
But thanks. Thank you for...
Yeah, you're super thoughtful. Like, I'm just like, whoa. I don't meet a lot of people who are that, like, you know, reflective and stuff.
It's the worst tranquilizers.
Yeah, that and... I'm thinking back to my other friend who's very reflective. She's a writer.
Yeah.
So horse tranquilizers and writers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're definitely, like, for writers, there's definitely, there's sort of a fixation with accuracy that you develop really early on, like articulating yourself accurately and communicating abstract ideas as precisely as possible, and even succinctly if you're lucky. And so it might just be a matter of, like, you know, part of your job is translating inner world, inner life, imagination, like really kind of unwranglable things into something that people can receive and digest and process, and maybe it'll make them feel better, or it'll make them think, or it'll, you know, sort of shift their perspective. And so part of that is definitely, like, you know, kind of playing therapist in your own brain and moving a lot of the parts around.
Is that why you write? Is to, you know, what you said a minute ago about, like, making people feel something?
Or
give them a new idea?
You know, I guess I wouldn't say that it's one thing. When I was around 5, like, something clicked in my brain. Like, my mom had this book of poems from Canada. She's Canadian. And it's funny, like, I don't know why this is, but, like, children's books and textbooks from Canada somehow are so Canadian. I wish I could explain how they are that, but, like, all of the books I remember from when I was a kid, it's just like, man, it's such a different tone than American stuff. But she showed me a poem about, like, it was just sort of, like, a very short poem about a tree and, like, wind in a tree, and I remember that feeling very distinctly of realizing that this is a thing that people could do. Like, you could put words in order, and it elicits, like, a reaction in yourself. Like, you have this weird endorphin rush of, like, expressing something accurately, or beautifully, or both, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was definitely something very, like, a very specific spark that happened where I was like, this is a way that I can feel if I continue to engage with writing, with putting words in order, you know, because that's really all it is.
Yeah. So what was it like when you first saw, like, words that you had written come out of, you know, a character's mouth or the scene you wrote and set up? Like, what was that first time like?
Probably mixed, you know, because I think mostly the first experience with it were in college where I would, like, write something and then shoot it with my friends or something like that. And Ira Glass has, there's, like, a blurb that went viral where he was like, you know, when you start out as an artist, you have really good taste, and the things that you make don't really match. It's like the work that you make doesn't cohere with the level of art that you want to make, and you have to just keep on making stuff until they're a little bit closer, like until the levels are a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
He said it much better. Everybody look up that quote. It's great.
We'll put it in the show notes.
But yeah, I guess it was really cool to see things that I wrote or things that I came up with committed to time-based medium. But it was also sort of a mixed feeling because it wasn't good, you know? It's like the student films that you make are student films. Like, there's a reason that they have a reputation as being sort of sophomoric or misguided or poorly produced, you know, because they are.
Mm-hmm.
Also, like, this was, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, so the technology just wasn't as good. And it's really cool to see stuff that's coming out now, or kids who are sort of coming up now, and how, you know, like, there's content, I don't like the term content creators, I'm just going to use it because I don't know what else to say.
Yeah.
There are really amazing people creating content right now where their access to, like, fantastic sound setups, it's like, that wasn't really something that was accessible when I was first starting out. And so I'm glad that I ended up sticking with it to a certain degree anyway, despite the fact that the things in my head, the stories that I wanted to tell, the way that I wanted them to look, the way that I wanted them to sound, was just not coming through in the work that I was making. So, you know. Mm-hmm. And as a writer, I get to leave that up to other people, which is a huge blessing, because production just, you know, it it presents you with very, very different challenges and logistics and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to be able to write something and put it in the hands of somebody that you know is really capable and talented. And, you know, they'll turn it into something really interesting and add to it.
Same question, but now on your first show, like, seeing it, you got paid for your work.
Mm-hmm.
It's broadcasted nationally, or probably internationally,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, how did you feel that time?
You mean with Over the Garden Wall?
Yeah.
Well, there's a weird sort of lag in animation where generally, you know, what I've experienced is that you write something and then you don't really see it fully produced until about a year later,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes it's a little bit longer for it to air. And it's different for stuff that is produced in the States, or for stuff that's not 2D. Like, there's a lot of different variables as far as that goes, but,
right.
But there's a lot of time to sort of experience every single part of the process until you actually get to the point where you see it on TV. It's very cool to see it. It's also really cool to see people respond to it.
Nice.
You know, it's like you kind of, when you're making something, you really hope that it'll find its audience and that it'll be people who kind of connect with it the same way that you intended them to.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I think that there are definitely, you know, the more experimental or, like, fine art kind of you get in any sort of visual art, I think probably the less tendency there is to think about exactly what the audience experience is going to be. But because the audience is generally children for cartoons, it's actually really nice to think about how they might receive it. And, you know, for me, it was nice to think about how I received cartoons and how I processed stories as a little kid, and the ones that really stuck with me and the stuff that really changed my life and kind of broke my brain open and made my life kind of, like, larger and better, you know, and, like, to know that, like, it's like I knew that that was something that cartoons could do because I experienced it myself as a kid, and I continue to with just regular television and other sorts of stuff, but, you know, it's like, it's definitely something that you end up considering a lot. You want it to be purposeful. You want the work that you put out there to make things better and to ripple in a way that's, like, positive and maybe thought-provoking, you know. I don't know if anyone actually aims towards, like, making cartoons life-changing, but, you know, a lot of them really are, and it's very cool to see that.
Nice. What were the cartoons that did that for you when you were growing up?
Well, there was a series on Nickelodeon that the Grimm's Fairy Tales, that was a big one. Like, I could probably recite, you know, the whole theme song. Like, it was very impactful. And it's funny because I did really like humor, but that show doesn't really have any. Like, it's really just kind of straight up, just, it's like you're being read a story. These aren't cartoons, they're books, but Asterix and Tintin, like, those were really very formative, and I'm really glad that my parents kind of stumbled into them, and that's basically how I learned to read. And so my first experience reading as a writer was with sequential art, and I think that was definitely influential. Plus, like, they're just so funny and well-drawn, and and they really do hold up, like, both of those series. And Belle and Sebastian was a big one. Like, that was sort of like a limited series, but I got very attached to the story of it, which is about, you know, a little boy and his huge Pyrenees dog, and he is sort of wandering around the world and, you know, trying to find his mom. It's based on a book, which I've never actually read, but that really touched on something very kind of deeply internal that I'm still processing the stuff, you know. It's like, yeah. When I think about the stuff that I really was drawn towards when I was really small, I think that there's a lot that you can discover about yourself and sort of how you formed as a person and what beliefs kind of...
Yeah. I think that's really something amazing about, like, fictional characters, particularly in media. Mm-hmm. So with, like you were talking about finding an audience mm-hmm. for what you create, I would think that the audiences between Harvey Beaks mm-hmm. and Over the Garden Wall are really different.
I mean, I think that with Harvey Beaks, there's less crossover. Like, Over the Garden Wall is more... It has more appeal for kids and adults and teenagers mm-hmm. and
yeah.
people from all walks of life. And I think that Harvey Beaks does have that, but it wasn't really packaged that way. And it's interesting. Like, it's a little bit of a bummer. Like, it never really did find its audience. Like, it found a small one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was developed at Nickelodeon for a long time, and... you know, I don't think I can really speak to exactly how things unfolded, but I think that it definitely would have landed with audiences if it wasn't made during a very turbulent time for the network. It kind of fell through the cracks, and I wish that it hadn't, because I'm very proud of what we did with that show. Like, I feel like when we went into it, one of the influences that Carl Greenblatt talked about was Peanuts, and The Wonder Years, and sort of these shows that
nice.
Really give you a window into, like the warmth of being a kid, and also properties that sort of acknowledge that kids feel sad, and that's a really interesting part of being a kid, and it's valuable to feel a whole range of emotions, and Inside Out did that so well. Like, mm-hmm. I wish that I had had that movie when I was a little kid.
Me too.
To sort of, to validate, like, it's okay to feel all kinds of things. Yeah. It's like, no one really tells you that, you know? It's like, you get a lot of messages when you're growing up, you know, especially as a little girl, like, you know, people say, you know, stay cheerful and be happy and you know, be sweet, and it's not like people are actually trying to limit your range of emotion or experience. They just want you to be happy. But the way that lands when you're a little kid is sort of like, you end up closing off a lot of parts of your own experience as a person. So, you know, that's all very lofty. Like, I like what we did with Harvey. I feel like we did end up touching on a lot of parts of being a kid that I don't think I'd really seen before. And there were a lot of different characters to work with, and they were very open to me bringing in ideas that focused more on the female characters, which was really awesome.
Nice.
And it was just a very, very supportive environment in terms of, you know, definitely in terms of gender and... in terms of content, you know, like it was a very soft landing. You know, I've heard a lot about what writers' rooms can be like, and I'm very glad to not have had a negative experience of one so far, because I've really worked with people who were very encouraging and supportive and excited about what they were doing. So
that's great.
Yeah.
So you said that you had expanded on the female characters in Harvey Beaks.
Mm-hmm.
Did when you initially pitched that, did you get any kind of like pushback at all?
At the very, very beginning, I think when they were still trying to figure out exactly what the show was, you know, it's like the first season, there's always going to be more conversations about like what direction do we want to take things in. I never got pushback from the showrunner or the story editor. Like, they were very, like, if anything, you know, they were just very encouraging about bringing that stuff to the table. And every once in a while, there would be a little bit of like, uneasiness from the network about, like, well, you know, we want to make sure that we're also, you know, that, like, the boys don't turn off the TV during an episode that's about this character. And the show creator and story editor would always speak on my behalf in meetings like that, and it was really, you know, I wasn't really in a position where I could speak up in front of executives yet. Like, mm-hmm. later, it's like we all kind of knew each other, and I was able to respond to things, you know, if I had to, yeah. with my own ideas and perspective. But at the very beginning, whenever there was pushback, you know, Carl would sort of swoop in and say, no, this is a story that we want to tell, and this is part of the show that we want to make. And so it was so great to have, you know, it's like, I feel like that's what it means to be an ally and an advocate and to really put your money where your mouth is in terms of progress. And so I think I'll always be grateful to him for that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I find it amazing that, you know, there's still notes given like that where...
It's not coming from a terrible place, you know, like, mm-hmm. in my experience, those notes didn't come from a place of wanting to shut down. It was coming from, it's sort of just a financial thing, you know? When mm-hmm. it comes down to it, like, executives are responsible for getting out good content, but they're also responsible for running a business, and mm-hmm. a lot of the concerns that they bring up, you know, a lot of it, luckily, they can leave to standards and practices to flag, and then, you know, we end up changing things a little bit later. But in terms of, like, representation and in terms of, like, fears and nervousness that people have about content and diluting it, I think the fear isn't anything but financial. And I can't really fault them for that because they are
protecting their brand.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that what I appreciate is when people realize that protecting your brand does not have to mean alienating women in the service of placating men, or girls and boys, as the case may be in children's animation. You know, a lot of the executives, like, they're not these faceless entities. Like, they have kids a lot of the time who they're thinking about when they think about the content of the show. They're coming at it needing to answer to a lot of people on the business side of things and on the creative side of things. And so I do not envy being in that position at all.
Yeah.
And, I mean, of course, there are going to be people who are in that position who are just blowhards or really misguided or, you know, sort of like the typical MBA who thinks that they have better ideas, you know, or more of a creative, like a more valuable creative perspective than the people who are creatives. And that exists, and it's fine. I'm very, very lucky to have not really encountered that very much in my own career at all.
That's so good. Yeah. I hope that continues for you.
Me too. I really do. And, you know, it's like people say, yourself for difficult situations. I think that's true. I hope that I am prepared if it ever does come up.
Yeah. So, female representation on the screen, like, what are your thoughts on that?
On any screen? Because there's a lot of screens.
Any
now.
Screen. Animation, live action,
oh,
just whatever.
Okay. Wow, that's a very large. It's like, how much time do we have? again, you know, I'm an optimist. And I try to stay excited about what's happening right now, which is mostly a transition that I think is very jarring for the industry of, you know, network and cable television to streaming. A lot of writers I know don't have cable. I used to have it. I kind of want it, but I know that I would just end up watching way too much stuff. Instead of making stuff. I guess I would say, you know, there are little things that happen that I'm very excited about. Like, there was just news that came out about how Jessica Jones' second season, every episode is going to be directed by a woman. That is unprecedented.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's been a sort of tokenism where you know, people, and like on Master of None, Aziz Ansari has talked about how this happens a lot with minority characters where there'll be a quota of one, you know, you can have one person of color on a show, you can't have two, you know, but then you see, you know, a network show like New Girl kind of being like, can I swear? F that,
yeah, yeah.
Whatever.
You can,
like,
yeah, you can swear. I wasn't sure what you meant.
Screw that noise. Yeah. You know, it's like there are changes that are being made. The pace is glacial. I wish it would go faster. I wish that issues of representation, not just for women, you know, but for so many different people, I wish that they would catch up with, you know, the degree of actual practical compassion that I see existing in the world. We've got a long way to go, but I feel like there's just been an exponential amount of progress just in my lifetime, just in the past 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
People are becoming more aware, and I'm very glad to see people, I mean, not to have, like, Schadenfreude about it, but, like, I love seeing people ridiculed when they double down on sexism. And so to me that's cause to celebrate instead of latching on to the lack of progress, which is, it's just going to be a thing until it's not. You know, I think it's interesting because before Twitter, even before this election, I think people thought that our country had really made a lot of progress in terms of race in a really alarming way. We have uncovered a massive swath of our population is racist in the most active and despicable way. And it's not just depressing, it's surprising. Because, you know, when you are a liberal, when you grow up in liberal environments, when you tend towards, like, living in cities, you know, there's a lot of different factors. But for me, you know, I never really had a window into that, like, how widespread it was, how second nature racism is for a lot of people who live in a country that I, like, unapologetically love, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it feels terrible that they have as much of a voice as people who are reasonable. But I would rather know that they're out there. And I don't know. I mean, this is a huge departure from talking about animation, but,
no worries.
You know, I do feel like it sort of loops back to just the issue of sexism, because I would rather know, you know, that sexism exists. I would rather the people who are incredibly wrong-headed and just delusional and idiotic about it, I would rather they be vocal. So that you can say, okay, like, so that you can point it out and agree en masse that it's ridiculous. That was the circle that happened in my brain.
I mean, it's stuff that's on everyone's mind, and
yeah.
And you guys are writing animation and, like, content, and of course, like, you guys are going to be thinking about those things.
Yeah. I mean, writing cartoons, you have an opportunity to impart, you know, very basic kind of ideas about just being a nice person, and, you know, you can push an agenda of, like, kindness and humor and, you know, sort of gratefulness and excitement about being alive without mm-hmm. having it be this sort of, like, charged political thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that does kind of prime kids' brains for processing larger, larger political things when it's time for them to do that.
Yeah.
So that's like a very high bar to try to hit, you know, and often it's not something that you have an opportunity to do depending on the property, but when you do hit it, it's like, okay, cool. Like, I'm not just writing stuff that sells chewing gum. You know, like, I'm
yeah.
leaving things in the world that maybe kids will see and it'll reassure them a little bit or make them think about something in a different way. And that's exciting.
Yeah. Do you think about that when you're making things that, like, if you were to, you know, die tomorrow, you, like, made something good with your time here?
Yeah, I actually had a weird, not like a cancer scare, like it was totally just in my head, but I got some lab results back, and I was like, and I got a call from the doctor at the same time, and I had to, I basically had a few hours where I thought that I probably had, like, kind of a death sentence. And it was a really interesting day, because I did have to think about, I think the first thing that I thought was like, well, okay, I've lived a lot of life, and I've done a lot of stuff that I'm really proud of, and I have, yeah, I think that I have done a lot of things that I feel, I mean, not just in my work, you know, it's like I there's been a lot of meaning and purpose. Like, I've been able to fit as much as I could into the time that I've had so far. But there was a really, really deep sadness about not being able to continue doing that, potentially, which turned out not to be the case, you know?
Thankfully.
Yeah, and so that was a good experience because it did kind of get me thinking about just, like, living better days instead of trying to have a better overall life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a really great lesson.
Yeah, I'm grateful for it, even though it was a tough few hours. And, you know, it's like, whatever, that could still recur and be, like, a real thing, but you think about people who, like, there are a few deaths, I think, that I'll never really totally get over. Not people that I know, but, like, Adrienne Shelley was a filmmaker mostly in the 90s, and she, you know, it was a terrible end to her life. It just felt like robbery. Like, it felt like robbery of a person and robbery of their, like, it's like just thinking about the work that she would have made and where she, like, she'd gotten to a point where I think the work that she was making actually did accurately reflect the work that she imagined in her head.
Mm-hmm.
And so having her get to that point and then to have her just, like, taken away, you know, it's sort of like, it's a hard thing to wrap my head around.
Yeah.
Sorry to get so dark.
But no, it's okay. I mean, Waitress was, I loved that movie. It dealt with a real issue that, you know, women face. And she did it with humor and, like, so much charm. And there was, like, a unique style to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I saw that movie, I, like, looked her up, and I found out she died, and I was just, like, that was the first movie I ever heard of from her, and there was so many other stories I'm sure she wanted to give.
Yeah, I mean, there's, it's like, you know, they make you read The Diary of Anne Frank when you are in middle school or high school, and I think the takeaway from that is supposed to be this cathartic thing of, like, well, her life didn't continue, but mine will, and, you know, indefinitely, but, like, you know, I'm here today, I'll continue to be here, conceivably, for the immediate future, and so, yeah, it does kind of become helpful. I wouldn't say that I'm a person who's, like, obsessed with death, or especially anxious about, you know, like, I'm not afraid of flying or anything. You know, like, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, wow, how did we get?
I don't know. But like this is
but I appreciate it. I mean, yeah, it's but I do try to think about sort of being like using my time well. And I think that that's a concern for most people. So I'm in good company.
So in making, we'll call it content for all intents and purposes,
sure.
You got to drive your own project back to Backspace.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Sure. Dominic Bisignano and I had gone to CalArts together, and we were both in experimental animation. We ended up taking the same screenwriting classes with Nicole Panter. And so we were pretty familiar with each other's senses of humor, and I think we always liked each other's work. We weren't especially close when we were in school. We became better friends after we started working on Backspace. Or maybe just after we graduated, like there was more of like an ongoing dialogue than there had been when we were in school. Mm-hmm. And I was working at the Prostate Cancer Foundation. And so I had this very kind of dry, you know, comparatively dry office job, and he asked me, he said that, you know, he was interested in going into Cartoon Network and pitching, and that he knew somebody there that we could meet with, and that he had scheduled a meeting in a couple of weeks, and would I be interested in coming up with something in that amount of time?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yes, I would like to do that. And it was really so cool to be pulled into that world, you know, just by a friend, by somebody that that knew, I think, maybe that I was capable of participating, of warranting a seat at the table or whatever. So he had the concept kind of nailed down about a world where things are like where everything goes when it's deleted from. I think originally it was just from like computers, and then it sort of turned into all like electronic devices. And we just met up pretty consistently and talked on GChat a lot, and ended up putting together a Bible for the show. And you know, he sort of had ideas for the characters that we ended up shaping in a way that I think made a little bit more room for my sensibility. And I mean, I think our sensibilities are very similar in some ways, but I was glad that he sort of made room for that. Like he brought me in wanting me to contribute to, you know, the entire process. And I think that that can be rare in a collaboration. So I like that part. And yeah, we worked on it really hard for a couple weeks, and then we went in and pitched. And the cool thing about pitching with another person is that you can speak to each other's strengths in a way that you can't really talk about your own strengths. And so that was pretty cool. And the person who we pitched to, you know, liked the idea right away and was like, okay, well, here's some things that you can do with it. That might make it more of a fit for the shorts program. And so we left the meeting not really being sure if it went well or not. But then a few days later, they emailed and they were like, we really, like, we want it. Like, we'll take it.
Nice.
And so we started developing it at that point. And it was just really cool to have the opportunity to put the whole thing together and to work with designers and, you know, to sort of assemble a whole motley crew of people to execute our idea. Like, it was awesome. It was really exciting. And writing it was also just very collaborative. You know, we did a lot of revising, and we played around a lot with what we wanted the ending to be. And Dominic, you know, I mean, we basically, the pipeline for it was similar to a boarded show where there was separation. Like, we wrote that line, and then Dominic boarded it.
Mm-hmm.
And he would bring me in, you know, at certain points and kind of, you know, we would brainstorm specific parts together or, you know, we would sort of, like, work through different parts of the story, or he would run stuff by me and we would kind of rework it. But for the most part, like, he sort of introduced me to what it was like to work on a boarded show.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we really wanted it to become a series, and I still think that it could have been one. A lot of times, I think it has to do with timing and what else is being greenlit and what else is being considered and what else is being developed. And so I can't really say exactly. I mean, I don't really know exactly what might have led to it being more viable as, like, a long-term property. I just wish that it had, because it was a really, really fun project to work on. It was really, like, the voice actor, like, it was the first time that I'd been in a recording booth, and you know, we got to cast the whole thing. Like, the Cartoon Network Shorts program is really, it's in line with their philosophy about, you know, giving creators enough space to make something that's, like, true to their sensibility and their vision. So it was just an amazing opportunity. And, like, the most sort of challenging but, like, valuable foot in the door, because it taught me so much about the whole process.
Would you be able to take it to any other, like, studios to pitch? Or because you made
it's
it
a little
them?
Bit tricky, and I don't know all of the details as far as, like, contractually how it works. Like, we got reversion rights, which basically means that you can take it to other places after it's done.
That's great.
But a studio would have to pay Cartoon Network the amount that it costs them to make.
Oh.
Plus, you know, residuals probably ad infinitum. So, you know, I'm not sure exactly how much it would be, but, like, for a studio developing original content, it's much more cost effective to just make something original and not, you know, there are shows. I think Adventure Time was developed at Nickelodeon before they took it over to Cartoon Network. Like, there are shows that have kind of gotten a second life. But there's, you know, there are a lot more people pitching at this point. So we have taken it out a little bit, and I think, you know, it's a little bit weird because when a studio looks at it, I think that, you know, there's the question of, like, well, why didn't Cartoon Network make it? Like, if they didn't make it, then is it really a viable property? Like, it's sort of, it has this residue on it, that you're hoping somebody can kind of see past. To me, it's a really fun idea, and I really, really like the characters a lot, and I'm totally biased, but I really like the way that we were able to execute it. And, you know, I don't think it'll ever be totally dead in the water. But it would be amazing. You know, it's like you're sort of always hoping that someone will, like, discover it and be like, yeah, let's turn this into a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it is like a show or something in that vein, or like a video game or a VR experience. It's like you get attached to the characters, you get attached to the world that you created, and you want it to exist in some format somewhere.
Yeah.
So that was a good experience too, like being able to realize what it is about, you know, about a story that people connect with, because we experience that ourselves, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, the fact that that didn't go forward meant that I was able to work on Harvey and Dominic was able to work on Star, and, you know, I think that when he started, he was already in a pretty awesome place as far as just being able to take something from an idea to a complete, you know, piece, an actual thing that exists in the world.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was really, really valuable to have, like, the past few years, to accumulate more experience as a writer that I can hopefully bring to the next thing I do.
Are you working on anything on the side?
I'm pitching a lot right now, partly just to get practice, because I think it's a skill that you sort of have to build. Like, you just have to, it's like stand-up, you know, you have to just keep going up and doing it until you get really comfortable with it. And it's also, pitching is kind of a numbers game in a way. Like, there's no accounting for taste. You really never know exactly who you're going to be. Like, you never know what a studio is going to be looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good going into it assuming, like, I'm going to do this, you know, 12 times before somebody decides that it might work. Or I'm going to do it 30 times and nobody is going to pick it up, but then the next thing that I come up with will land in a way that's, you know, it's like,
mm-hmm.
you just throw everything at the wall and hope that something sticks.
Yeah.
And you try not to make anything that you wouldn't want to work on for a long time. Mm-hmm. So.
Do you think there's any project that if it didn't get do it yourself, like Kickstarter or something?
Oh, I don't think I would do Kickstarter.
Or just crowdsourcing.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be specifically Kickstarter.
I mean, I think that that's a really fantastic way of getting things made. I think I'm too anxious. I mean, I'm not generally, you know, especially not outwardly, like, an anxious person, but just the thought of the experience of, like, watching the numbers go, you know, it's like sort of holding your breath and hoping that enough people get behind your idea. Like, it's nerve-wracking enough trying to get, like, 4 or 5 executives behind an idea. Like, taking something... I think if I was, you know, if I was an established comic book writer, or if I had some sort of, like, presence in crowds, to, like, then I would crowdsource. But as it is, you know, when you're a writer, it's like you're sort of, you're behind the scenes, and there's less of a reason for people to, you know, to sort of rally and get behind your work, because it's like, who are you, you know? Like,
yeah.
You're a person with cats.
That's relatable.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, other things, too. There are other things about me, but I think those are the main things right now.
Do you have any advice for young women getting into the industry?
Know that what you're bringing to the table is as valuable as men. Don't ever let anybody shake your certainty about that. You know, it's like, maybe, it's like, your work is either going to land or not. If you ever get the sense or even a blatant indication that it's because of your gender, then don't stand for that. Don't work with those people. Don't lose sight of why you got into it. I think that's an important one, you know, probably for men and women, but more so for women, because, you know, I think it is sort of true that in certain positions, for certain jobs, like, you do have to work twice as hard to prove yourself to the same extent. So I guess I would say, like, do that. Actually do work twice as hard, but also, like, once you get to a point where you've proven yourself, try to gently nudge people towards awareness. And also, don't ever go into a room assuming that people are going to be dicks, you know? Like, if every room that you go into, whether it's your first time in a writer's room, whether you're pitching something, whether you're interviewing, whether you're just going in for a general meeting, like, assume that you want the same things, which is to make good stuff. you know, people who are in charge of employing you or of buying your ideas, they want you to succeed because your success is their success. So if you go into it knowing that chances are you're on the same team, then you'll be in a better position to have a good experience and to make better work. I think that's, yeah, that's the main thing. I want to avoid platitudes. I don't want to just say, like, be positive, but, like, it's just, you know, consider your own experience and why you're in it. And if it doesn't feel good most of the time, then find another path, you know, like, yeah.
Very nice.
Oh, cool.
It's beautiful. Where can people find you online if you want them to find you?
Sure. I mean, I am on Twitter. It's like right now my feed is almost all just like political humor, retweeting, you know, really funny stuff that people are saying that makes the whole election seem less like horrifying and,
mm-hmm.
And disheartening. So yeah, if you like jokes about how precarious our ill-advised empire is, then you'll love my Twitter, which is just my name. It's at Amalia Lavari. Other than that, I don't really have much of an online presence. Like, I have an Instagram where I, like, put pictures of, you know, my cats. I think the last thing that I posted was, like, a pile of yarn. You know, like, it's all very, like,
mm-hmm.
Oh, this lady's probably 80 years old. which I'm okay with. Like, I look forward to my geriatric years.
Yeah. Lots of time for making things with yarn.
Yes, making things with yarn, sitting with people and schmoozing, you know, taking mm-hmm. walks, looking at trees. It's like, this is the shit that I live for right now. I'm glad to have come to that conclusion, you know, that there's pleasure to be mined in really banal stuff.
We will end right there.
Okay.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Amalia.
Sure, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
We hadn't met Amalia before this interview, and I can't imagine not knowing her after having met her. I loved hearing Amalia's thoughts on being introspective of your own childhood to create thoughtful content for today's youth. I'm going to be taking a lot of what she shared with me into my own career. And, you know, we would love to hear what you'll be taking with you. Share your thoughts with us over on the Twitter page at Ink and Paint Girls. That is Ink, the letter N, Paint Girls. Let's chat soon. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving a review on iTunes. It helps us reach and share these stories with a wider audience. In sharing these female voices, we strive not only to help pave a path for aspiring women professionals, but to build a community and safe space for female creatives to support and empower one another. Like life, working in these industries is not a destination, but a journey of hopping from project to project. So I think we can all use the support. Want to chat? We're on Twitter at Ink, the letter N, Paint Girls, on Facebook at Ink and Paint Girls Podcast, or email us at inkandpaintgirlspodcast@gmail.com. The Ink and Paint Girls Podcast is brought to you by me, creator and host Cassie Soliday, and produced by Val Patrone in sunny Burbank, California. Music composed by TV's Kyle. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Pink Girls Podcast. Thanks for tuning in.